Do we have a new treatment for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease?
Is bariatric surgery durable if it's performed in adolescents?
Speaking of bariatric surgery, what about mental health problems in those who undergo this particular procedure?
And taking a fresh look at frozen stool transplants.
Oh, that was very clever. Welcome to this week's look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on January 15th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences System in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, it was so clever to hear you say this fresh look that it actually blew away my concentration for a moment. So why don't we turn first to that study? That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
C. diff infections are a huge problem, with over 500,000 reported yearly, and they account for about 29,000 deaths, particularly in older individuals, those that have other conditions. We've talked before, it's becoming more refractory to treatment with antibiotics. First of all, it's caused by overuse of antibiotics, and then it's resistant oftentimes to antibiotic therapy. So C. diff infection can be recurrent or it can be refractory. And how do we deal with those circumstances? We've talked before about the use of stool transplant. That's called fecal microbiota transplantation, or FMT. It can restore normal bacterial colonization to the colon. That can actually be a very effective therapy. It's difficult to do, though, because you have to screen the donors and take a fresh stool transplant, time it. Well, it would be nice if we didn't have to use fresh stool specimens. If we could take and screen individuals, take their stool sample and freeze it, later thaw it and use it to do a fecal or a stool transplant. And that's what this study assessed. They looked at over 232 adults that had recurrent or refractory C. diff infection. They all received fecal transplant via rectal enema. Half of them received it via fresh fecal transplant, the other by frozen, and they were equally effective in resolving the C. diff infection. About 85% of the time, after one or more fecal transplant, the infection was over with.
Clearly, then, this reduces some of the barriers relative to employing this technique for people with C. diff infection, but you and I have talked before about the potential for capsules of the material and other ways to kind of ease this transition. Tell me, in that scope of things, how you feel this particular frozen aspect fits.
I think we have two studies now, one using frozen fecal material delivered via capsules and now via rectal enemas to show that it is effective. Now, is one of those methods of delivery more effective than the other? That's, I think, the next place to study.
Okay, so we'll look forward to that one. Since we're talking about procedures then, let's turn to one of the two, and I'll allow you to choose which of these two you'd like to talk about, both regarding bariatric surgery, one in adolescents, and others discerning mental health problems among those who undergo the procedure.
Well, let's talk about its use in adolescents first. Bariatric surgery is being increasingly used in adolescents, particularly those with really severe or massive obesity. If you perform it in adolescents, is it effective in reducing their weight? And as importantly, is it effective in reducing the multiple medical complications that are associated with it, things like diabetes and high cholesterol and hypertension? The investigators looked at over 240 adolescents that had undergone weight loss surgery. About two-thirds of them had gastric bypass. The other third had a sleeve gastrectomy. And they followed these individuals for 3 years. The average age of the individuals is about 17 years of age. Most of them had graduated or about to graduate from high school. About three-fourths were female. And when they looked at the end of 3 years, they discovered about a fourth of these individuals were no longer considered obese. Those that had type 2 diabetes, it resolved in 95% of individuals. Those that had abnormal kidney function, it normalized in 86% of the individuals. High blood pressure normalized in three-fourths of the individuals. So this demonstrates that it can be very effective and the results are durable over 3 years.
3 years, of course, nice period of follow-up. But one of my questions about the use of this particular procedure in adolescents is how durable are those results? And as we've talked about before, this instantaneous resolution of type 2 diabetes, I just wonder if that stays away over the long haul, particularly if they don't really reduce their weight significantly.
We won't know that until we follow these individuals over another 5 or 10 or 20 years. The thought is, however, many of these abnormalities are likely to be more reversible if they're addressed in adolescence rather than waiting till adulthood. Now, the other issue is, are there side effects? And there were a significant number of individuals that had micronutrient deficiencies that needs to be followed. And about 13% needed additional abdominal surgery.
I don't know if we mentioned this one, of course, in New England Journal of Medicine. So why don't we turn then to the one in adults, and that's in the Journal of American Medical Association, taking a look at, let's call it, coincident mental health conditions in those who undergo bariatric surgery.
We know that there's a certain baseline incidence of mental health disorders in the general population. Is there an increased incidence of mental health disorders among people seeking bariatric surgery? Does mental health disorders affect weight loss? Does bariatric surgery somehow affect the mental health disorder for individuals that have it? To address these three questions, the authors looked at all studies between 1988 and 2015 that looked at either the prevalence of mental health disorders, how they affect weight loss, or how weight loss affects them. Here's what they found. About 23%, about a fourth of the patients seeking bariatric surgery do have mental health disorders. Depression being the most common, about 19%. Binge eating disorders in about 17%. And anxiety in about 12 or 13%. They did not detect that there was any difference in weight loss or outcome among those with mental health disorders and those that did not have it. There was a lot of variability, but there was no consistent story. There did seem to be a improvement in the number of individuals that had depression and the severity of depression in those that underwent bariatric surgery. Now, again, that's an association.
I guess I'm wondering about the utility of this study. It's kind of somewhat of a dumb moment for me that people who have bariatric surgery might have depression or other eating disorders. If we know that 1 in 10 or 1 in 5 people who undergo this procedure have a mental health issue, what's that really do for us with regard to either pre-op or post-op management?
For those that have depression, you might say, well, does the surgery worsen it? This would suggest that, in fact, it actually improves it in many individuals. And you might say, well, since the incidence of having a mental disorder is high, about a fourth of the patients have one, maybe we should make sure we do a terrific job of screening for it so it can be addressed. If it's not better with surgery, we have other ways of dealing with it as well.
And of course, I would have to say with regard to both of these two studies we've just discussed that I'm in favor of prevention. So if somehow we can get our arms around not allowing people to become morbidly obese with a multitude of interventions, that would be the best case scenario as far as I'm concerned.
And I agree. And I'm going to extend that to the C. diff infections. Let's prevent those too by unnecessary use of antibiotics.
All right. Well, now that brings us very nicely to our last one, where prevention would also be desirable. In folks who have COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, almost always due to cigarette smoking, although sometimes to industrial or employment exposures, a little device that can actually help them feel better when their disease becomes severe. That's in JAMA also.
Emphysema is a key component of what you've described as COPD, and it's where the lung tissue becomes pretty inelastic. Those areas of the lung begin to hyperinflate. It compresses the other areas of the lung that aren't as affected. And one of the therapies that has been proposed, and this has been shown to be effective in certain subsets, is to do lung reduction surgery. But that carries a lot of morbidity and mortality associated with it. Can we do something that's less invasive that can reduce those hyperinflated areas of lung? And by doing that, we can improve individual symptoms and perhaps even prolong their life. Well, one of the ways to do that is to put in little coils. These are called nitinol coils, that's the particular material they're made of, in the areas that are hyperinflated. And those act to reduce that segment of the lung volume so the others can expand. And in this particular study, they looked at 100 patients with COPD. Half of them, they just routinely treated. And the other half, they used the same medications, but also put the coils in. Here's what they found in the 100 patients. Those that received the coils, they did have an improvement in their physiologic function. They were able to walk longer after 6 minutes. They did improve how they felt. There were modest improvements in the lung function. Finally, there was no difference in mortality.
I think this is really good news because these things can be put in with a bronchoscope, so there's not a lot of risk that's associated with their use, with the potential for some pretty good upside.
There was an alleviation of symptoms. This was also a cost-effectiveness study. What is the cost? About $750,000 per quality, that is quality-adjusted life year. And remember, it didn't improve survival. With limited resources available, do we want to spend $750,000 to make people walk a little bit longer after 6 minutes? So that's one issue. But again, price will come down. The second issue is we talk about personalized medicine. Can we identify patients within this study that are likely to receive the most benefit? People in which the Emphysema is localized instead of being scattered throughout the lungs seemed to benefit more. Extending this study to those individuals may allow us to find the patient population that gets the best benefit with the least cost.
All right. On that note then, I'm going to talk about the C. diff treatment in the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.